This is on the deeper implications of mindfulness for conflict resolution, which could be anything, right? But what we are going to be focusing on is a particular method of mediation that Gary Friedman, you have all met already in the plenary, and Jack Himmelstein developed, and which they have been teaching recently, along with Norman, who's been injecting the mindfulness. So we're going to be focus on that as a way to go deep, and look at the work of Ron Kuttner, whom you haven't met maybe, at least not in the plenary. Ron is a professor at Creighton University Law School in their program on graduate program on conflict resolution, and has the distinction of not being a lawyer. Thank you. And well, look at this. We have two people who are not lawyers. Ron has a PhD in conflict resolution from Bar Ilan University in Israel, and his focus has been on Buddhism and conflict resolution, particularly mediation. So I would like to just put Gary's method of mediation, which is called understanding-based mediation, into the context of mediation more generally. So how many of you are
mediators? You feel powerful now, Len?
I feel great. How many of you are mediators? Okay. So for those of you who are not, you're all sort of familiar with mediation?
Yes. Yes.
In which a neutral third party helps other people resolve a dispute, trying to be neutral. I have spent most of my, the last 30 or 25 years writing about different kinds of mediation, different ways to categorize mediation and different approaches and so forth. Gary and Jack Himmelstein have been focusing on developing one particular model of mediation. It took them at least 15 years or more to give it a name. They finally came up with understanding-based mediation. In some ways, this is an extreme form in that it has some qualities that some other forms don't have. When I first learned about mediation, it was in Gary's office, and I think I mentioned this in the plenary, but the idea is that I thought that's what mediation was. It turns out to be a particular form to which I'm especially drawn. It is especially conducive to mindfulness, to the integration of mindfulness. But there are other kinds of mediation. Some are so narrowly drawn that they're very much like a settlement conference with a judge, in which you might typically talk only about law and legally relevant facts, none of this other stuff that we've been discussing. I just do want to say, should I summarize your model, and then you could correct me, or would you rather do that?
No, use it.
Okay.
You're the guy that tells us what we do.
Okay. Here's what they say they do. I don't really know what you do now. I know what you did 30 years ago when I sat in Gary's office, but the essential idea is that the foundational task is to develop understanding between the parties and among the parties and the mediator, help people understand themselves and help people understand each other. And out of that should come a way to deal with the problem that recognizes their various interests and concerns. They try to go as deep as the parties are willing to go. And the other thing that it, for which their model is, I would maybe say, notorious, is that they don't use a private caucus. So that's been controversial. Maybe we'll have time to talk about that, because I think there might be a connection here with the other work we're describing. So this model was, in a way, a fringe model in the United States until recently, but it has been for many years the dominant model in Switzerland, Germany, and Austria, and now has in recent years has just become very well known and very popular in the United States, partly because of the publication of a great book, which you'll see on the table, by Gary and Jack, called Challenging Conflict. So we're gonna see more, a little video. Gary will introduce it about their program, and then Norman and Gary will talk a little bit about it. Ron will talk about their work and also how his work relates to it. I may say stuff, and then we can all talk. Okay?
Okay.
You ready?
One quick question. You mentioned private caucus. What is that?
Oh, I'm sorry. In most mediations in the United States, there are private meetings between the mediator and the party or lawyer on one side. That's very normal, as opposed to what goes on in trial, which I know is, you have a litigation background. But in this particular model, they don't do that. And we may want to talk about that.
So everybody in the conflict is in the room at the same time, always with the mediator. They don't go
right
off.
That's, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, thank you.
Private caucus is never used, ever?
Well, Gary can explain it later. I don't want us to get distracted on that point.
Sometimes.
Okay, let's, we don't want to do that.
That was very zen of you.
Right. So, we're just about to see this video, which I have to say has been... It came about as a result of my frustration in writing a book for the last year and a half about this thing that Norman and I have been doing for the last 4 years, where we've been trying to teach people to how to sustain access to themselves and to be able to use that, what happens within themselves, when they're working with people in conflict. And so my son, who's... 30, said, well, this is, you know, your book, it seems like, first of all, it's never going to come out. And secondly, people won't really get the feeling for what you're doing by writing a book. And he says, why don't you do a video? So I said, well, of course, I have no idea how to do that. So this is now just, I think, maybe 3 months after we had that conversation, and the video is done, you're going to be the first audience to ever see it, because we just got permission from everybody, I think, as of Tuesday, that was in it, because we gave everybody veto power. Mm-hmm. So it's, you'll see it. I think it just speaks for itself. So we'll show it, and then we'll see.
Okay, so you need to say anything about the scene here?
I think you're not starting at the absolute beginning, is it? No, you are starting at the beginning.
Yeah,
no, it says
within a half a minute.
It all speaks of the
felt as mediators this far.
Oops.
What?
Oh no. Oh no.
We had sound for a second, didn't we?
Yeah. Yeah.
Does anybody know anything here?
Recognize your inner light.
It works.
It's probably the most powerful tool that you have as a professional to help people in conflict.
If we don't know what's going on
with
ourselves, then everything comes out sideways. And I saw that in myself, not only in political practice, but in my relationships. I kind of felt like I was drowning.
Long after I'd been a mediator and was good at it, I thought, this is actually personally a terrible thing for me to do. Speaking to the coping skills I learned, to defend myself in a really dysfunctional environment.
How do you work with someone in an effective way when you have all these feelings coming up? As a lawyer, you don't learn how to know what's going on with you.
Typical day like today, I show up, I come rushing in, and when I walked in the room, I'd leave my feelings at the door. That's basically what would happen, and as they would arise, I would shove them out of the way. On the outside, people saw me as being pretty calm and pretty settled. On the inside, I was, I think, relatively troubled.
We see people at their absolute most difficult moments of their life. We have all learned, those of us who learn to be professionals, to keep our distance. A professional keeps your distance from your client. It's unprofessional if you let yourself get close to the client. I can give you a great game face that will show you that I'm not there. I'm a neutral. I'm a non-judgmental person. But it turns out, like it or not, even if we're trying our best to put that mask on, we have reactions to these people. And those reactions we have to those people matter tremendously. What we do with those reactions will have enormous implications for what happens with their lives, and by the way, what happens with our lives. I'd always heard, as a mediation teacher, that people either are born mediators or not, that you really can't teach the central mediation skill, the ability to tap your intuition. And it seemed to me that that idea was wrong. When I came to that realization, I immediately thought of my old friend and colleague, Norman Fisher, who's a Zen teacher.
I'm used to thinking of everything that I do as being completely useless. So the idea that somebody's making use of us, making a difference in the world, is thrilling.
We designed a program enlisting the busiest and most successful conflict professionals we knew to make a 9-month commitment to a daily practice of learning the art of self-reflection and applying it on a daily basis with a lot of support to see what difference that would make with their clients. They all had a sense that in the work they were doing to try to help people in conflict, that the key somehow was their own self-awareness, and that by unlocking that, that they would really become better conflict professionals.
We all have a similar goal. We want to do better. We want to do better work.
I wanted to shorten the time frame between knowing something was going on, to identify what that something was, mm-hmm. and then third, to be able to respond to that.
It's not like I'm opposed to the splitting because on ideological grounds, the mind-body split, divorcing ourselves from our moral compass, it's because it doesn't work.
And it also, it sounds like it's not true.
Right. It's true as long as you can keep a little insulated piece of ground where you don't have to feel anything, mm-hmm. but you can't actually do that.
Using your own self and your own personal feelings and what's going on the inside, that's necessary. This is an immersion that you're not going to find someplace else.
I knew that it was something I was being invited into, that it was different and unique, mm-hmm. that nobody else was doing it, and it was going to be like an experiment.
Norman and I devised this rigorous program where people would have a variety of practices to help them learn to use the muscle of reflecting on themselves and understanding themselves, especially when they're working with people in conflict.
I think the buddies were the centerpiece of the whole process.
Having a buddy was what I needed to be able to make my practice regular.
We talked once a week.
We would talk about our work. We would talk about how we feel in our cases.
I feel like we're really helpful to each other, mm-hmm. and we're able to be really deep about kind of spiritual and personal and reflective issues.
Mm-hmm. Rather than the them, it's really how we are doing in relation to the outside.
I've known Peter forever.
We were used to have lunch, but it was, relatively speaking, on the surface.
What's going on? How are the kids? He was one of those people who had not been primarily self-reflected.
All the energy that I was putting into keeping the feelings away was really like almost like being at war with my own feelings. So here was conflict outside with the clients that I'm interacting with, and then conflict within me that was trying to work on trying to keep the feelings away. It just made it worse. The shift, which seemed very counterintuitive to me at the time, was to embrace the feelings.
Now we have lunch once a week. It's like a completely different person that I'm having lunch with. I mean, our conversations are completely different.
We really, stay with the basic buddy framework.
We would ask each other the questions.
What's going on for you?
What are you thinking about this?
What were you experiencing when you were experiencing that?
What judgments are you having? What do you imagine is going on for the other person?
Just be a buddy and listen. And get as deep as possible.
It's been a complete change.
July 23rd, 2007. Today I notice ease, I think it was the writing that gave me the insight to see it, to feel it, to acknowledge it, to admit it, and then to begin the process of working with it.
I remember the first time I actually had that flowing writing happen, and it was really exciting. It's like, whoa, where's all that coming from? The writing has really helped me to focus and look inside about my part of these relationships. Mm-hmm. Joan is an extremely intelligent victim, yet not fully. She really wants the divorce over, yet when settlement's on the table, she can't let go of something, feels wronged and hurt, gave up a lot during the marriage and have less of her child. She can't see or acknowledge how she is contributing to keeping this going. What is my part? What am I avoiding or denying? My family worries about me working too hard. I avoid the conversation, deny any impact on my health. I'm working on this issue of denial, but it's slow progress. It's just easier to avoid things. It starts with the client, but it ends up with me, and then it changes my relationship to the client. Instead of judging her for who's going through way harder stuff than me, I can see how I do that in my own life, mm-hmm. and it makes me more accepting, mm-hmm. which I think makes her feel more comfortable. And at the same time, if I look at my part, I can call her on her part without having a double standard. And I think that somehow that comes across.
Mm-hmm. The main question of whether people will be stuck inside the conflict trap that brought them to some outside professional will depend on whether or not we can understand that inner part of the conflict trap, and we can't do that from our outside. We have to do that from our inside. A core concept that we came to develop with the help from our colleague Jack Himmelstein was what we call the V, a systematic and progressive effort for people to deepen their understanding of what was happening to them, particularly when they had strong emotional reactions to clients, and to reconnect to their clients from a place of connection and compassion.
What did you understand the V to be?
I understand it to be a tool for figuring out what's going on with me in relation to a client or another person. It could be another lawyer or whatever.
You're starting with a conflict. What's going on with me in reaction to this situation and these people?
Feel those feelings. There they are.
Centered and focused. My feet are on the ground.
Coming into the body.
Feeling how I'm feeling. Am I uptight?
Breathing. Identifying particular emotional experiences like anger.
It's like, I'm making judgments here.
Or frustration or disappointment.
Or, I don't like this person.
And I'm really here and I'm not thinking about other things.
And I can be honest with myself about that. And uh-huh. I might say, I don't want to have that feeling.
Feeling what they feel like physically.
I go down the V.
What's happening here.
And it's like, I have to get past something, and then it comes to understanding. Am I angry with you? Yeah, but are you a person? Yeah.
Okay, now I know what to do with that.
And then you can go to the options. On the upslope, it's kind of like, and? Kind of like that.
That at least has the potential of opening up my eyes in a way that then allows me to approach them in a different way.
It's like lightning, it's the process of Skippy has shortened the time between having the feeling, identifying the feeling, understanding what it does and how I should respond to it, and then proceeding from there.
The group developed a very cohesive bond, and after 9 months realized that the support that they were giving and getting from each other was absolutely critical to their being able to sustain their practices.
So when I feel the community support for me, that it really leads me to want to be more of a community of support for others. Mm-hmm. And I also see that you are that for each other. Mm-hmm. And I also see, in some ways now, you're getting it back from the people that you're bringing it to.
I had a client that did call me on the carpet for something. I remember accessing the feeling, and the feeling I was getting was defensive. I really needed to stand up for what I thought needed to be said. But getting in touch with those feelings knowing that they were moving me towards defensiveness, I was just able to be honest in a genuine way. Then it was a whole different discussion. Mm-hmm. Then it wasn't us beating each other up or her beating me up and me defending myself. You know, and suddenly we were connected. And then we became real.
Yeah.
And that's such a different conversation. Skippy has made me a better mediator, not only because of how I feel when I come out of a session, but how I see my clients reacting.
My goals have been to shorten the time for realizing things, and that's definitely happened. In a meeting, I'll realize that I'm having a reaction, I can figure out what it is, and I can use that information. It really can and does make a difference in how you relate and how you work, because it deepens our work, it deepens our relationships, personally and professionally. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to stick to.
We need each other to be able to sustain what is really something that kind of goes against the grain of how most people go about thinking about conflict resolution.
I've gotten to know a number of people from the Skippy group in a much deeper way than I ever would have in a much shorter amount of time. Susan seldom spoke in complete sentences. She would start to say something, she would get distracted and go in another direction, then get distracted again, and then get distracted again. And sometimes it was a little difficult to follow her because you weren't quite sure where she was going to be next. That changed.
I am a much better conflict professional. Mm-hmm. And it was really a period where I grew up and became a wiser person. Mm-hmm. And really started feeling like, wow, this is my place now.
Mm-hmm.
She was much more identified as a mediator. Mm-hmm. And her role as a mediator. Mm-hmm. She seems much more relaxed.
Mm-hmm. How did they do it?
And just very connected. Mm-hmm. Very connected to what's going on with them.
Let me ask you a question. When you're really there with them, and you really get them, and you say, here's what I think is going on, when you have that aha moment, like, I am really feeling like that. And it changes, the room changes.
You can teach the core of mediation skill, and they can learn it. And it isn't simply a question of whether they have it or they don't. We'll continue to offer these opportunities for the people that haven't had the chance to do it, to see what this real relationship is between the inside and the outside. This is, I think, at the core of what effective conflict resolution is about.
If you take this seriously and you follow the structure, it would be really difficult not to change.
Excellent. Do you remember who made this?
I think I'm sure.
Yeah. I said my son did this, right?
No, yeah. He didn't say that.
Oh, he didn't say he did it?
Yes, no,
no.
He did.
Oh, yeah. Anyhow.
Cassidy Friedman, and he was a business card up here.
He mentioned his son. He didn't mention that his son created the film.
Right,
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, he mentioned that. Yeah. The idea.
Yeah.
Not that he made.
Yeah. No,
he's a videographer.
He did the whole thing, and I was working for him.
That's great. So, I have just one quick question. When you're running this course, is it in the context of people trying to use your model, or maybe not, or it doesn't really matter?
Actually, it's for mediators, it's for collaborative lawyers, and actually we also have litigators in it.
Oh, so it's not.
So it's really all about, it's about conflict resolution.
Okay, great.
And it's actually not even just lawyers, we have some non-lawyers too.
Then I didn't have to explain all this stuff about your model. We just blew about 5 minutes for you. But it's a very important model. So let's take a couple of questions and then, Rachel?
Can you say again what Skippy stands for?
Yeah.
And explain
Yeah. I'll say what Skippy stands for. You tell them about the V. Skippy stands for self-reflection. Self-reflection for conflict professionals intensive. That's what we called it. We had to have something that kind of say. It was also helped me to remember that was the name of my first dog. Norman, why don't you talk about the V?
I think you should do it.
I did.
Yeah, the V. Good.
All right, so the V, Jack and Norman and I really developed this together, and it's still in progress. And the idea is, it's actually backwards in the video.
Yeah,
it's backwards. But you start with body breath. That's how, and it's really about how to work with really hard, bad feelings that are really difficult that you experience inside. So, it's that moment in the room, somebody said in the plenary, you know, shock, or there's something really, you know, there's something that's really registering in you, and you can just, you know, it just kind of comes into you. So you, you get it in your body, you notice in your breathing. Those are the signals that we learn to take the signals as the invitation not to push the reaction away. But now we have to find some way to work with the reaction. And our idea of working with the reaction is we deepen our understanding of what's happening inside us before we then figure out how to work with the people that we're working with. So usually underneath, as we start to penetrate this, we start to get their feelings, that we start to identify their judgments. Often the judgments have that kind of really heavy feeling of kind of pushing and separating ourselves from people, the feelings. And we then have to kind of work with it more and start to find out, well, what's under that? And so it's kind of unpeeling these layers and starting to go down the V, and we find out under these judgments and feelings is there are other things happening with us, and often there's fear comes out. I mean, it's just amazing how often when I start to go inside, fear is there, and it just seems to be so core, and almost no matter what seems to be going on. Eventually, when I start going inside, fear is usually pretty strong. We're not trying to program this for everybody, but this it's just more a sense of getting the feeling of progression. And then there's this, and these are all kind of separation experiences, and now we want to start to find some way of getting putting ourselves back into relationship to the client, because these are about us. Now, actually, Amy in the video says, and we've been thinking about bringing this back into the V. Enough about me. Now I'm starting to think about what could be going on with this other person. I've shut them out. I've closed them off. And now I'm kind of curious about them, and I'm interested. And so we used to have, and we may restore this to the V, is what's happening, our sense of the other? What could be happening? And it's at the very least curiosity of what could be happening in the other person. And then to try to bring that to a sense of ultimately connection, where we start to feel ourselves in connection to them, and out of the connection and the feeling of connection, we can start to go up here into some kind of expression. But the basic experience is deepening our own internal understanding of what's happening, finding the place of, and also a place of compassion, which leads to connection. And it's not exactly, you know, we're drawing it in a kind of linear way, but it may not happen that way for you. But it's out of that, you got to come up. This is not about being inside, it's about, and that's why it's the V, is now with the people we're trying to help, we find some expression. And we started to kind of categorize those and catalog them, and we realized there's so many that, and we're still working on it, but I think what we're recognizing, there's a kind of platform here of work we do to build qualities inside ourselves that will help us, will be kind of the springboard for the expression, and we're starting to identify some of those qualities and seeing some commonality that people are finding in that.
Let me add something.
Yeah.
I'll just add one. Let me add one part to it that I think makes it clearer, because this is the internal V, This is what goes on inside of the mediator, but also inside of the parties. And previous to this, there was the external V, which had to do with the parties on either side of a divide, and this is the conflict. And the original concept was, you think that the way to solve the problem is to go across this gap, but actually the way to solve the problem is to go down to their real concerns. And why is it that this thing is bothering you? Let's get below the level of the problem to find out what's really going on, and then you can come up to more lasting solutions. And so then the question was, well, how do you get people to do that? And what's going on within you? And then the insight was, oh, you have to do this kind of work yourself in order to affect that in them. You've got to think about yourself in order to do this. And then the counterintuitive thing is that all the emotions that you were pushing away, that you thought, these emotions stand in the way of my helping the parties, it turns out that it's just the opposite. That if I acknowledge my frustration, my anger with the parties, my like, my dislike, my fear, through those emotions, I'll get to compassion and connection. And that's the part that you really don't think so. You know, you don't believe it. You think, I got to get rid of those emotions so that I can... And so that's the counterintuitive piece and the part that takes some training. And you, because it's so habitual not to want to go there, right? You want to get rid of that. You think that being a mediator and being a neutral means getting rid of that. And this is saying, no, you have to learn the skills and techniques of how to work with them and get to a place where you can really connect to the people. And then when you can do that, you can help them, sometimes wordlessly or just by atmosphere, and sometimes by techniques in specific ways, you can help them to do that same work. And so that kind of showing that there's a, this is the inside the mediator, that's the party. So that's the different piece I wanted to have.
So before we actually developed the V, we used to have Norman come in the middle of mediation training programs, advanced programs. And we'd put him out there in the middle with a couple of people, Norman knowing nothing about mediation. So what would you do with them? These people would get into this terrible thing.
In the middle of a role play.
In the middle of a role play.
And it would go like that?
What?
And it would go like that?
No, what happened was Norman did this thing, which we called the V, doing a Norman, which is just going deeply into himself and finding something there that we then now started to kind of trying to develop in a more kind of systematic way.
So,
is there an aspect of Tong Lim in what you're doing here?
We have used that. Yes.
Someone should say what that is, but just quickly.
It's a meditation practice that generates compassion by being willing to take in pain.
So bring in the pain, you bring out compassion.
Right.
You can feel it within your body.
Yeah, right.
So, before you do this in the program, I'm assuming you're teaching them to meditate first, so they can be mindfully aware and more able to do this.
Actually, it's a funny thing. In the video, it didn't say in the techniques. It talked about writing, and it talked about what was the other one? Buddy system,
right?
But one of the main things we do is meditation. So meditation is one of our very most important techniques. And
you're right.
For some reason, it wasn't in the video.
Yeah, just to be clear.
We teach them meditation, and we drill in meditation. We practice meditation in the trainings. If we have a long training, we'll have an early morning meditation and a meditation during the day and so on. Yeah.
We actually have 9 different practices, self-reflection practices we use, but meditation is really the kind of the core, but it's kind of hard. It's a little less sexy on the video, so I think Cassidy didn't get excited about it.
And when you say self-reflection, you don't mean mindfulness meditation. You mean other things, or do you?
Self-reflection, what we mean, I think, is self-reflection as a bigger category. Mindfulness meditation as a technique for promoting self-reflection.
Okay, but there are
And there are other techniques as
great.
Well.
Yeah, we didn't want to get caught into saying, you know, this is the Buddhist way, and that's what everybody should do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's also, I see Claudia is here, so she could chime in here.
Claudia, you look terrific.
You're one of our stars.
So,
get over
apathy
yourself.
So the idea was, we weren't going to say, you have to do this, but meditation turns out to be really kind of a core way.
Yeah. You know?
to be able to do it. So I'd like to ask Ron to comment, say anything you'd like about what Gary and Norman have been doing, and also tell us a little bit about the course that you teach, conflict resolution from a Buddhist perspective.
One interesting thing that may stand out as a paradox or tension here, that on one hand is very self-reflective and going inside, on the other hand, you said so articulately, it's enough about me. And it's interesting, and I think you started in the book, I'm going back now to the book, the whole notion of double looping and being with others in a way that it's not just what I understand, but also kind of reaffirming what I understand with others. And I'm trying to connect with others in profound ways. Here you're taking it more deeply. As I think Norman was saying in the pre-conference retreat, self-awareness and self-reflection is not self-consciousness, it's something else. So it's enough about me. So we're going inside, but in order to discover a different and new way of being with others. And this will kind of lead me a little bit to what I'm doing. I mean, just to give you a background, I'm a philosophy and history and philosophy by years graduate. I mean, I did go to law school for 1 month. My father still doesn't forgive me for quitting and going to take philosophy and arts. But what I'm doing in my course is first of all give people a little bit of understanding of the zeitgeist, the 20th century, where we're at. And there's a huge tension between what's happening in the intellectual world, in physics, quantum mechanics, in biology, system biology, in political science, in psychotherapy, in almost every field. You see that the 20th century, if you want, and in philosophy, of course, phenomenology, hermeneutics, post-structuralism, sorry for the name dropping, it's all about... It's all about questioning our language, Aristotelian language that we use to speak, which is the notion of the substance, this innate internal core that we hold dear and near to our heart, which is who we are, our identity, this thing that is identical and we carry everywhere. It's a new understanding about relation between subject and object. So the 20th century, if you want, also starts with Nietzsche, who was a student of Schopenhauer, who was reading the Vedas, so it comes from the East. But the 20th century is about speaking a new language that Buddhism comes into very, very neatly. And Buddhism, I think, is also, and Buddhist practices and Buddhist philosophy and psychology is a way to, it's a vehicle that can help us do the transition between what I see as an enormous gap between our understanding on the intellectual level and what's going on in our day-to-day, sad, alienating, very individualistic lives that we're living. And this gap needs to be breached. So when I approach my students, I approach on two levels. My course is 8 meetings, 3 hours each meeting, an hour and a half, very intellectual, very cognitive, and we don't need to shy away from that. Sometimes when we're into the Eastern practice, as we say, no, it should come from a different place. We should put away the intellectual parts. We shouldn't shy away from it, one, because students can relate to that. They can appreciate that. And two, because we can set the ground for the challenge that Buddhist thinking and Buddhist practice is setting for us. We understand what a radical system it is. Radical in terms of radicals, going to the roots of the matter, and the Buddha teaches to uproot suffering. We need to go all the way to uproot suffering. So this gives a context which is important. So that's the first half of each meeting of my course. The second half, just sitting and just practicing and taking whatever I do gradually on a theoretical level into the practice through practices. I use a certain practice, which is Gregory Kramer's, those of you who know, Inside Dialogue. I think he's doing a very interesting and profound work, which is to take the Buddhist practices into the interpersonal realm. So it's not just about, and I'm now relating to the question that Doug Kodiga asked in the retreat. He was asking, well, how do I take the meditation practice into the world afterwards? How do I bridge the gap? How do I make sure that, what do I do with this frustration? Because then I get attached and cling to this beauty and centeredness that I had when sitting on the cushion, and now I have to go to the world, so even more suffering. So both Gregory Kramer and David Bohm, who's an amazing intellectual quantum physicist, by the way, quantum physics, which again, subject objects there, it's a different ballgame, right? Niels Bohr, who was one of the first people that wrote about quantum physics, was a Buddhist practitioner. Okay. Anyway, this guy also, when he writes about dialogue, what these two are saying to us is that the dialogical practice can also be a meditative practice. Meaning it's not just I sit on a cushion and meet the world, but me practicing with others can be also a practice. Notwithstanding the personal practice. So when I'm talking about the practical aspects of my course, first of all, it's the sitting, and then I send them home also with a link from a website, and I ask them to sit. I tell them, you know what, the link is 30 minutes. Don't do every day, and don't do the entire 30 minutes. Start with 10 minutes or 15 minutes, and every second day, every other day. But it's a gradual process for them to start to understand how the theory that we're talking really means something, because a distinction that I make is between understanding and realizing. I just said about the importance of the theory, but at the same time, we should watch out from, oh, emptiness, oh, dependent co-arising, oh, there's no me, there's no self. It's a joke. I mean, it means nothing on the intellectual level without the realization, which is the combination of the intellectual understanding with making it real and concrete in our everyday life. So there's hardcore Buddhist philosophy, the Four Noble Truths, and the understanding emptiness and understanding dependent co-arising. And there's hardcore, not hardcore, but just giving a context of understanding 20th century, understanding the challenges and the questions that we all ask with our wish to rethink the subject-object divide. And then it's hardcore dialogue theory, because those who wrote seriously about dialogue, and I talk about David Bohm, I talk about Martin Buber, Charles Taylor. Again, I don't want to start with the name dropping here. But those who wrote deeply about dialogue, they all, in a way, questioned the notion of the self as an entity that stands on its own. So I also teach a negotiation course. And the students that come to my dialogue class already took a 3-grade called negotiation. So we did reflection 1.0, and we did do negotiation, and we did interest-based negotiation. And now we're asking ourselves, is interest-based really what we want to do if you want to go and to a deeper understanding of human relations, okay? So we have the hardcore philosophy and hardcore understanding of dialogue, and then we move to Buddhist psychology, and I use the Patita Samuppada, the 12 links, as in, and I work with it as a model for conflict escalation, and then they take it to the practice, and they have to do journals at home, and they have to do practice, and they have to choose their links, which are their weak spots, and understand how, on the interpersonal level, where is their suffering and where is their ignorance and blindness, the avidya, the not seeing life? How do we shy away, or what I would call withdraw from the relational space, the dialogic space, and how the meditation practice can help us do that? The beauty of the inside dialogue, I'm making adjustments to the inside dialogue framework, is that it's with the six simple guidelines, simple, as Norman says, simple on a theoretical level, obviously way more difficult in terms of implementation, but you can take them to the interpersonal realm. So when we do the practical aspects, part of it is sitting and sitting during meditation. Part of it is meditating in dialogue, meaning having conversations, deep dialogues on, by the way, always topics that come straight from the Dharma, the heavy, important topics that the Buddha was talking about, and always in alignment with what we did on the theoretical level. So it goes hand in hand or side by side. And again, I don't use a bell, and we don't sit on the floor because we have to be cautious, and I don't want to scare people, so we sit on chairs, and I clap hands every once in a while in order for them to go back to the guidelines and to observe where they're at and see what's going on in themselves. And then we're having the group discussion, which again, we're trying to bring the dialogic practice into the dialogue. And then they go home, and they have to keep practicing that throughout the week and write journal of how it goes and what's happening and what is it that they, the weak spots, and what it is that they need to work on. So at large, I'm saying, first of all, we have to understand what's the philosophy, the context, not to shy away from the theoretical aspect. That's what I do. In this respect, I think I somewhat disagree with the notion of, well, it's not Buddhist. I say it is very Buddhist, at least for me. I take mindfulness from its origins of, as I understand it, from the Buddha. I wrote my PhD with someone who's kind of like Norman, is a Zen, Soto Zen master, but he's also a university professor of Buddhism, so it's a combination. I was sitting with him also for 10 years, and he was both my Zen teacher and my university professor, so it was a very interesting combination. My journey was amazing. My journey is amazing in class. I'm always aware and reflective about the dialogic practice within which I take place with the students. How do we create really a vessel for dialogue, and what does it mean for me in terms of my being in the classroom? And again, dialogue opens opportunities that negotiation or other terms don't, because the profoundness of dialogue, and what these people tell us, dialogue is not conversation, dialogue is not negotiation, dialogue is not discussion. It's a different way of being. Martin Buber, by the way, before he wrote his I and Thou, not many people know, but here in his archive in Jerusalem, you can see that 6 years he was studying Buddhism before he wrote the I and Thou. So it all works together very beautifully, ties in very beautifully, and what they tell us, it's a different way of being with others, what I would call the relational space, the relational, recreating our ability to be to relational, be with others. And as Buber says, in the beginning there is relation. For a religious Jew to say, in the beginning there is relation, saying that the most basic category is not me coming to a situation, but there's a situation from which we co-arise again and again anew. And this is almost crazy. And students at first, they hate me for even bringing that. And they hate the idea and they don't know what's going on. But we build trust, and not in me, because as the Buddha says, the teaching means nothing if you don't really develop the conviction through the practice. But the practices, one by one, allow the students to start understanding what really deep interdependence is in a world, again, a sad individualistic world where we prefer to guard ourselves to ourselves within ourselves, very Kantian or Aristotelian world. They end up the 8 weeks. I'm working also with a professor who's more of a quantitative researcher and wanted to do pre and post. And when he wanted to do the post interviews, I told him, let's do the interviews 3 months after the course. Because I don't need the excitement. I mean, at the end of the course, when they wrote their evaluation, it was amazing. So the best thing, I mean, it should be the required course. Now, it's Omaha, Nebraska. You can say whatever you want about the Midwest. I was offered to make it a required course in the program. I said I don't want to, with all my belief that this is the thing. Mm-hmm. I said students that come to a conflict resolution program in a Jesuit school in the Midwest, they don't need to be obliged. To, yeah, I won't talk to you about me being a Jew from Israel teaching a Jesuit school Buddhism. And I gave a talk on Jesuit values with all the Jesuit priests sitting there. So let's not go into that. But I don't think that it needs to be required. So at the moment, they have to choose between this course and another course that I'm teaching, which is group facilitation. So it's not a required course, but it's also not an elective. It's like either this or another course, mm-hmm. which is very advanced, I think, to offer not only offer such a course, but really make it a course that people are encouraged to take it.
What is the other one?
Group facilitation. How to work with group, I tell them group facilitation is mediation 2.0 in the sense that it's taking the third-party role, but working with groups. This is negotiation 2.0, meaning if you're interested in the interpersonal, delve further in the dialogue. So whatever is more important for you. So I told the guy who was doing the interviews, let's do the interviews 3 months later. Why? Because with all the excitement, if there's frustration that something that I'm asking myself, how do we maintain the practice afterwards? To what extent do they really take it to their hectic world and really do with it something? It's a huge problem. I mean, I do follow Buber also wrote on education. So one beautiful saying that I like to take from him, and he says that all I can do is take my students to the window and point outside. Some of them really thank me after the course. What will happen if I meet them 2 or 3 years later? Will they still be practicing? Will they still, if the seeds that we planted really kind of ripen to something else? Gee, I don't know if I have an answer there, so...
So what I want to say about this is I'm assuming most people are in the room have some familiarity with Buddhist psychology and philosophy, but not everyone. Is that true? I'm guessing there are a few people who are not reasonably familiar. What I want to say is that what Ron is attempting to do here and doing, the Buddhist philosophy and psychology that he's presenting is extremely complex and hard to understand in an intellectual way. I mean, really hard. What I do with that stuff is try to make it as simple as possible. He's getting
inviting them right in to the middle of and helping them deal with the challenges. So
well, I don't know how to take, and now I'm a little bit anxiety because Lenny is now reviewing a paper of mine for my promotion, so I don't know what he needs here.
I wrote it already. Okay.
But I want to get it. I'm trying to make it easy. I'm trying to make it clear, put it in clear terms, and again, by applying it to Western terms. And again, if I go to complex adaptive system and concepts that define them there, if I go to relational psychotherapy, developmental psychotherapy, Keegan style, if I teach them a little bit about what's post-structuralism, Derrida, Foucault, and the whole notion of discourse and the deconstruction of the self there, it makes it a little bit more applicable. I mean, we already have people that are translating some of the profoundness into Western frameworks. Yeah. So that makes that less strange.
Cool. So comments and questions, the two approaches that are really trying to go deeper here. Yes.
So grateful to hear that you're doing this. I got my master's in conflict resolution from Antioch about 5 years ago, and I made it a lifestyle choice instead of a two-year program because I wanted what you're offering, and they didn't have it. Mm-hmm. So I actually took a course with you and that you were in at Harvard a few years ago. Yeah. You and Jack.
Yeah, Jack.
Ooh.
And then a couple other folks, and you were there. And I was searching for all this on my own because it wasn't within the structure of the Antioch program. Mm-hmm. This is a fairly new program at Creighton, isn't it?
Yeah, a few years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yay. Because I now have the world's most expensive master's degree. I spent 6 years looking for this on my own, so I think it's awesome that you can get it.
And papers are coming out. If you want, send me an email. I'll put on the website.
That'd be great. Yeah.
So, even Ohio State Journal, very central, kind of mainstream, good conference journal, there's a big piece coming out soon. So there's more recognition.
Ron has a piece in the new symposium in the Nevada Law Journal, which has 9 articles about conflict resolution and mindfulness. So.
Just to share a little piece about Buddhism and its infiltration into society. And this is really funny, I haven't thought about this in years. About 15 years ago, I'm in a Marriott in Atlanta, Georgia. And in every room, believe it or not, they have the Book of Mormon and the teachings of Buddha.
Hmm. In Atlanta?
In Atlanta. Okay? At a Marriott hotel. Wow, okay?
The Book of Mormon.
Yeah. And the other thing I just wanted to comment on the internal V, just a quick personal story. I'm doing a mediation about 17, 18 years ago, a divorce mediation, and I had just extricated myself from what I call the 5-year relationship from hell. We've all been there at some moment in time. And this couple presents themselves, and what they want to do is get divorced and maintain a business partnership continuing. And as I observe the dynamic across from me, it's the relationship that I just stepped out of. And I go, oh shit, look what God has sent me, and I've got to process that V to get down to the bottom and go, can I responsibly do this? And fortunately, it both turned out well for them, but it was an extraordinary learning and healing experience for myself. So thank you for codifying it in some way.
Yes.
I'm struggling with resistance here, and before I became a law professor, I practiced in Santa Cruz, and I prosecuted sexual harassment cases. And going into mediation with my clients was a nightmare, because these were women who had been sexually violated by their employers. And as I'm looking at the V, and I'm thinking about a client, I mean, I'm feeling a lot here, as I'm imagining trying to help myself and my client get to compassion, some of my clients didn't even want to be in the same room with the opposing side. Mm-hmm. So, and I'd love to hear something very concrete about, you know, and I'm sure other people in different contexts would have similar, I hope, questions that they could relate to an answer here on how you get from A to B.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, just to put it in context, is the broader question I think you're raising, and what I'd love you to address is, when is doing all of this appropriate, and when is doing some of it appropriate, and when is doing none of it appropriate in an actual
I think it's always appropriate. It may be that what you're, you know, when you get to the deepest place in yourself and feel the connection with the person, that out of that you say, I can no longer mediate, or this isn't appropriate for mediation. So it's not as if this is all just supposed to bring you together in love and connection to people so that everyone is together. It's also to really support people from your most authentic sense of what you understand about the situation, the people you're working with, your limitations, and also possibilities. So the key here is, if you can't do this, forget it. That you'll be able to help anybody else do this with each other. If you can do it, not at all clear exactly how you'll be able to get, if at all, other people to do it. But for us, there's no turning back on, it's my contract with people when I work with them that I'm going to be there for both of them. And this is the only way I know how to do that when I'm feeling like I want to get out of the room, or I want to get them out of the room. Or,
you know, I would add to that that if you've been violated, you have a lot of pain and suffering, resentment and anger in your heart. And nobody can wave a wand over you and make that go away. And you might have to carry that for a really, really long time. But I think it really is important to understand that this is the way you have to go someday if you can. Because if you think that it's right and good and inevitable for me to be stuck in fear and reactivity and anger forever and ever and ever, then that violation that happened in one day goes on and on every single day for the rest of your life. And you cannot be held hostage to that. Even if you can't get there for the rest of your life, there should be the hope and the understanding that it is possible. Somehow, if I get help, if I work at this, and that somehow I can take this violation and turn it into love and wisdom. Maybe I can't do it for years, maybe I can never do it, but if without that possibility, there's only the tragedy of what happened to you, and then that violator wins the game 150%, and you can't let that happen. So I think anybody who works with people in that situation has to be able to tell them that, and as Gary's saying, you can't tell them that unless you know that. Because you've experienced it yourself, and you can say that to that person with authenticity. I know that that's true, and you know the depth of what they suffered, and you're willing to take that in. You're willing to take that in. So that's hard work, you know.
And maybe the success of that mediation is the person says, "No, this is where it stops," and I really got that, and so now we proceed in some other way. And I call that a very successful mediation if I help the person get to that deep understanding of the situation.
Yes. So maybe one other word to add to the bottom of this V would be forgiveness, because
we talk about that a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I just wanted to ask about the qualities, because I can imagine that some of them would be, you know, truth, non-harming, non-violence, that sort of thing. But maybe that's too religious for these kinds of situations. So I'm wondering, how do you describe those qualities, or do you describe them?
Well, we had the group actually develop them, the Skippy group, and they started to, you know, what do you need now that you've, you know, to be able to kind of make this muscle work? Mm-hmm. What do you need to develop in yourself? So there were things like courage. Courage seemed to be a very common one that people really... This is dangerous stuff. I mean, it really feels like it puts us in a very vulnerable place, and we need to kind of if we're going to create something that's really different in the way we work with people, there are a lot of qualities that we may have already, but there may be other ones that we really need to work on. And Kurt, you remember any of the others, Norman? There was Claudia.
Courage.
The ability to sit with suffering.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Was really
quite good. So yeah. I guess it's less about how should we express, or what is the best way to express, and more about what do you need in order to be able to express.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then the expression has to come out of you, how you express. I'd just like to say a word about what Ron was saying, because I really appreciated, I think there's a very important point in this, and it's great that you can unabashedly talk about Buddhism and place Buddhism in a philosophical and cultural context. Because I think that we have a problem, you know, in our culture. The problem is that we're all terrified to speak about religion because we're afraid that if we say anything that sounds like religion, suddenly we will polarize people, or somebody will stand up and with spouting some other religious ideology, and we'll get sued, or we'll be in some kind of a... Mm-hmm. So we have the idea in our culture that... and then we have these laws about... but the truth of the matter is that just like Buberian philosophy is a useful framework that adds something, Buddhist philosophy is a very useful framework that adds something, Christian thought can be a framework, Jewish thought, and so on. So I think we have to realize that we're hostage to this, and that this is an intellectual, cultural problem. And it's a problem to... I don't think anybody here, myself included, is interested in proselytizing or converting anybody to anything. What we're all interested in here is what actually works to bring people together on a kind of basis of universal values, you know, cooperation, not aggression, connection and love, you know, not hatred. I think we're all interested in the same things. And whatever works that brings that about in a cultural matrix, we should be able to use. And when we sort of say, well, I better not talk about Buddhism because it's not allowed, and I'll find another way to say it, and when we find ourselves kind of translating, we find ourselves in a kind of manipulative frame of mind around mm-hmm. that, and that becomes very eroding. Yeah. So I understand that I'm not saying we all have to come out and talk about Buddhism. I think in a way, you can do that exactly because your framework is so much academic and intellectual. You can place Buddhism, and that really is actually a huge help for the rest of us. That's mm-hmm. to me, that's really, really important. And somehow, we have to be able to, through the kind of work and the writing that you're doing, I'm sure that little by little by little, you will create a situation in which culturally it will be okay for the rest of us to be able to use Buddhist things without feeling like we have to be careful because now we're trying to foist our religion off on other people. So the culture is changing. You know, it's changing, and this will be more and more possible. So Buddhism is not just for Buddhists, and Christianity is not just for Christians. You know, that's the important point. And our culture does not recognize that kind of way of looking at it.
Right. But, I mean, the other idea, which I'll give Ron a couple seconds, but I think it's very valuable to distinguish between Buddhism in the sense that it's a religion and Buddhism in the sense that it's a philosophy or psychology.
Yeah, so maybe that's one good way
and
of
I,
doing
so
it.
I tend to say Buddhist thought or philosophy or psychology, not Buddhism.
Yeah, yeah. I tell my students in the first meeting that if the Buddha had lived today and was an academic, which building will we put him in? Most likely it would be psychology.
Yeah.
Not that it fits, but the Buddha teaches, I know suffering and the end of suffering.
Yeah.
This is what I teach.
Yeah.
That takes away the ritualistic and the religious aspects, and it doesn't challenge or contradict each one's religious belief. Again, a Jew and also in a Christian in a Jesuit school, I want to be appreciative of the school.
Okay.
I want to be appreciative of the Jews that are doing that. And one last word, I think you were asking about qualities, and I want to tap into something that you said in the panel before, which is that the best moments you don't really know what you're doing. I think one of the qualities that we teach with letting go, I use Ellen Watts' The Wisdom of Insecurity and the same songs, Don't Know Mind, or Beginner's Mind if you want, the Japanese Zen version of helping people to be insecure in a wise manner, to let go of our very firm concepts that we inject or impose on situations. But again, allow the fragility of co-arising of our understandings and our insights, and again, not bringing our own, I know what things are like. Okay?
Yeah.
So let me say, we should have ended a couple of minutes ago, but if you want to stay a few more minutes, there are several people who had their hands up. I don't think we can have a back and forth, but if there are people who would like to say or something or raise a question to have it in the air, yeah.
I had a question particularly for Gary in the sense of the concept of understanding and maybe how that's evolved for you in the course of your work, particularly because it seems like the V has this element of self-understanding, and then in the mediation context we have shared understanding. And looking at coming back up the V in terms of expressions, where are the points of integration as you see them in the nature of self-understanding and shared perhaps? And is it arising out of that place of the where from? Is it arising out of the how, the process that I go through? To reach my own understanding? If you could talk a little bit maybe around how understanding has shifted.
That's a big question.
Let's get on a couple of other questions, and then maybe people can talk to panelists about them later, because we really have to get back upstairs for a minute. Claudia? And then.
Well, this is really an observation, and I really appreciate that Ron and Mommy are bringing up the religion aspect, because I'm struck by the fact that all four of you are Jewish. Most of the men who have spoken...
I don't know how we allowed few Christians to take people as teachers.
And most of the men at the conference who have spoken at the conference are Jewish. Most of this, I don't know about so much about the participants, but I'm completely struck by how much Jewishness or Jewishness of origin there is here. And how, and that can't be an accident. And so I found myself, especially in this, I think maybe it's Ron, some of the things that you're bringing up, really distracted by that and kind of looking for what the meaning of that is.
Wonderful topic. I mean, we could, let's talk about it outside because we have to go on, but this is, we've got the full house, would we call this? usually there's somebody
minion.
Else.
It's called a minion.
Minion.
But this is true all over the United States.
Yeah.
There's something going on here. Yes, I'm sorry.
My question is this video going to be up on your website?
It is
because
on the website
like
now.
To share it with all of
yes,
you.
And please great. Feel free to do it. It's excellent. Yeah, understandingandconflict.org.
Okay.
Yeah.
Someone in the back had.
I just wanted to add with the sense of compassion. I worked with domestic violence victims, and then terminology also survivors. And not that what the perpetrator did was ever to be accepted or to be right. But some of the best things occurred when there was an understanding that that person had been wounded prior.
Mm-hmm.
And humanizing that made survivors not accept what they did to them, but understand, and then to move forward. Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank you. So one more really quick comment, and then we have to go. Thank you.
It's just a practical thing. I wanted to let everyone know. If you need the MCLE paperwork, it's over here. There's the list and the little half sheets. And if anyone would be willing to fill out that evaluation as well, it would be appreciated.
Wait, you can't leave until I ring the bell.